Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today, including one who'll take over my microphone for half the show. In moments, we'll talk with Jane McAlevey, a familiar voice in these airwaves, about organizing, power, and some serious and fundamental threats not only to unions, but to the very right of workers to organize at all. And toward the bottom of the hour, I'll hand over the microphone to the journalist Liza Featherstone, who will talk with Jane about sexual harassment and how to think about it politically beyond the call-out strategy. First, Jane McAlevey. Jane McAlevey is a longtime union organizer whom everyone should listen to, not only on the topics of workers and workplaces, but also politics in general. Her bracing question, which she asks frequently, "What is your theory of power?" is one that everyone who does politics in any way, either as analyst or activist, should always have in mind. Too many people conceive of political action as taking the right stance in an act of moral witnessing. That's American Protestantism for you. Rather than thinking about whether and how they can influence events. As she wrote in her book, No Shortcuts, which was published by Oxford University Press a little over a year ago, an incorrect power analysis can lead people who want to end capitalism to think that small numbers of demonstrators occupying public spaces like parks and squares and tweeting about it will generate enough power to bring down Wall Street. It won't, obviously enough. Recently, a lot of people, including me, wondered why progressives were able to organize some fairly effective opposition to the GOP's attempt to repeal Obamacare, though the thing may suffer death by a thousand cuts rather than one fatal blow of the sword, but seemed unable to mount anything to oppose the horrid tax bill. I thought Jane might have some good answers to that question, and she did. Jane is also the author of Raising Expectations by Raising Hell, a memoir of some of her organizing campaigns, which was published by Verso in 2012. Jane McAlevey.
So it's fun to talk with you, Jane, because we talk about power.
It's one of our favorite topics.
Yes. A lot of people have been scratching their heads wondering why there's been so little resistance, a loaded word, to the tax bill, in contrast with the fight against the Obamacare repeal. And we saw all this mobilization to preserve Obamacare, as flawed as it is, but this horrendous tax bill has received nothing of that level of opposition. What's going on here?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is, I think there has been a lot of sort of grassroots protest around the tax bill. But when we're thinking about the resistance or the theory of the resistance, as it were, I think what some people get confused about, which is generally what happens when people don't have a good analysis or understanding of how power and power structures work, is that people saw a lot of activity in the campaign to defend Obamacare from the right-wing attack, from the new Trump administration attack. But you saw a lot of grassroots protests around the tax bill, too. But there's a really key, the key factor, in fact, that cuts a really big difference between what the fights to stop the tax bill look like versus what the fights to stop the repeal of Obamacare look like. And the key deciding factor was the role of corporations in the fight. So when progressives misunderstand power because they look and think, well, hey, we stopped, you know, it took three votes. You know, it was a valiant effort. I don't want to diss the idea that people didn't do good work around defending Obamacare in multiple rounds, right? There were multiple rounds to that fight. And three times in a row, three different efforts at repealing, quote unquote, Obamacare, progressives believed incorrectly that they were capable of stopping the attack on Obamacare. What people didn't understand is that the actual power in the fight to sort of stop the attack on Obamacare was that healthcare corporations were on the side of progressives. The American Hospital Association, the lobbying law firms that actually support the nursing home industry, the skilled nursing facilities, home care, and a lot of state governors, et cetera, were on the side of defending Obamacare because it's bringing huge, by the way, taxpayer subsidies into private corporations. So fighting to defeat the attack on Obamacare, we, quote unquote, progressives, radicals, whatever, had a divided corporate class. So we had corporations, nursing homes, and a bunch of insurance companies. We had a bunch of really key sections of capitalists, of corporations, on our side Because why? It's about putting taxpayer money into private corporations at the end of the day, right? That's what the Health Care Act did. It just made it better so that more people had access to health care. When you look at the tax bill, that same alignment of progressives teaming up with a big, important section of the capitalist class of corporations, which is the health care lobby in this country, that fissured. Because at the end of the day, corporations and the super rich, which is who the healthcare corporations, insurance companies, nursing home lobbyists, et cetera, are, they realign with their proper alliance, which is the rich and the other corporations in the tax bill fight. So the level of power needed to defeat the tax bill was not well understood. It was never just that. Like, this is what happens. We defeat the Obamacare stuff and the resistance, as it were, a whole bunch of groups in there, put out a message that, like, we have actual power, that tweeting and social media and a bunch of little protests is what actually defeated the attack on Obamacare. When what actually defeated it was the alliance, crucially, with a huge sector of actually very powerful corporate class players, which is the hospital association, the nursing home industry, and the insurance industry. So when those players are working with progressives in defense of Obamacare, we can win. When you strip the ability to build that alliance and you go after the tax fight with tweets and social media, I'm sorry, that's like a butter knife to a bazooka.
Now, you had some experience in a fight to resist Medicaid cuts under the early George W. administration.
Yeah.
What was that like?
I mean, this is where the insight comes from, really. And I talk a little bit about this in Raising Expectations and Raising Hell in the whoosh, feels like 100 years ago book, right? I talked about what was called what became publicly known as the Put Family First campaign in 2003. Bush came in and issued a budget early in 2003 that essentially gutted Medicaid. And we framed a fight back against it with the employer class, with the hospital employer class and the healthcare employer class, as an attack on fiscal relief to the states coming off of 9/11. I mean, there were some particular things going on, but we essentially saw the single, until right now, by the way, until like what they just did in the tax bill, until the repeal, essentially taking out the mandate, which is going to functionally kill Obamacare. Until right now, there had never been such a big attack on Medicaid and the ability for working class folks to access Medicaid funds at the state level until George Bush did the attack in early 2003 in the budget. They were going to gut Medicaid. So I was working at SEIU. You know, we got to give Dennis Rivera some credit on this front. Dennis Rivera, who was the old head of, at that time, 1199, the big powerful healthcare workers union in New York, came down to headquarters in DC and said, look, I think that we can stop this if we build the kind of national employer collaboration, dangerous words, but you know, you can see where they went, by the way, a few years later. But in 2003, if, in fact, George Bush's cuts to Medicaid had lasted, there would have been literally millions of poor people unable to get health care in 2003. So I'm working at that point as National Deputy Director, one of four at the National Healthcare Division for SEIU. And Stern decides, because of Dennis Rivera coming to him, to say, I actually think we can reverse these cuts if we make a really strategic alliance with the employer class, with hospitals. Now, that's what Dennis Rivera and 1199 New York have been doing. There's a lot of criticism around it. In some tactical way, sort of brilliant.
We do have very generous Medicaid in New
York
State.
Very generous, yeah. Right. That's what I mean. It's strategic. There have been issues around it. For example, let's not get distracted on the issues. There are some issues around it. But if you look at it as just cutthroat, kind of brilliant strategy, we're talking about power and strategy right now, right? So if you look at it as a sort of brilliant power analysis on strategy, New York winds up with incredibly generous, I think the most generous, because it's California, New York, for the same reason, because they both have strong unions, by the way, right, who can actually team up with the employer class in the hospital association and the nursing home industry and go at it. The providers, the insurance companies, the hospital corporations, and the nursing home industry will team up with unions on very few things, but one of them is going to get more Medicaid money because it really benefits both. And so for the trade union side, it's a weird alliance that we can also make where, as a leftist, I don't feel dirty, for sake of argument, right, because there's a lot of employer alliances that we could make that we shouldn't be making. But the fight to like use the healthcare lobby, you know, using them strategically to actually do something that's going to help actual working class and poor people, that was a good deal. So when those cuts were coming through, Dennis Rivera called up Stern, Andy Stern at the time, the head of SEIU, and said that he had just sat down with the Greater New York Hospital Association, which is all the employer lobby, right, for the hospitals in New York. Everything about that alliance at some meta level is just a bad thing in terms of how our taxpayer money is used or not used. But anyway, in the short term, it's a great thing. So we're going to try to roll the New York model of working with the healthcare industry to to put Medicaid money back in the federal budget to see if it was going to work. SEU had never attempted this. AFSCME had never attempted it. The labor movement had never really attempted it because, in fact, part of the crisis of the trade union movement right now is that it's been so reduced, it's strong in about 10 states. And the 10 states we have aren't enough to move 50 states worth of senators on a huge budget bill. So think about the Bush era, the context then, Republican control. So SEIU couldn't go out and like run a lobbying campaign and win. So we figured out we had to actually make an employer alliance. And I was put in charge of the national campaign. There were a lot of things where I had to sort of swallow my normal attitude to run the campaign. But by the way, we won, and it was super effective. And in 2003, in a two-month period, we had, you know, this is how real power works. We had, I'll just say loosely, in excess of about $15 million that we spent of employer money teamed up with SAU and AFSCME money. And we ran a field strategy that involved, at the time, ACORN, that involved the Center for Community Change, that involved the Northwest Federation for Community Organizations. Like, we made a national map and we said, how many votes do we need to restore $120 billion, that's $120 billion in Medicaid cuts that Bush had just made with a Republican-controlled House and Senate? And we understood in making a 50-state map that SEIU and AFSCME could only move people in 10 states. We had 40 more states of senators that we had to like to overcome Republicans overcoming a Republican budget that was bad for the working class. So we stitched together. We had Catholic Healthcare West. We had Kaiser. We had Healthcare Corporation. I mean, we had the most unusual bedfellows, basically the same corporations that I spent my life teaching workers how to fight these companies, right, in every single contract negotiations we were doing, were the companies that came to our side. So we did it, and we won, and we set a table that had SAU and AFSCME at the center of the trade union side of it, made a really interesting coalition with a bunch of community-based organizations where the trade unions actually had to learn to trust the community-based groups and actually understand that in that moment, community-based organizations actually had power that the labor unions desperately needed. And then the third component of the fight, which was crucial, was that we had to bring in the hospital association and all of and the nursing home industry lobby, and that they could take care of sort of right-wing, Republican, red GOP-controlled states. And we made a 50-state map and actually did it, like reversed the biggest single cut to Medicaid at the time in the history of the Medicaid program.
Is there any lesson in this fight the fight for single payer?
The only lesson is really that people have to think carefully about power, because in the fight for single payer, we would have most of those allies would fall off against us, right? So the fight for single payer means we actually have to think much more carefully about what are the mechanisms that we're going to use to build power. What we should understand is actually how very powerful the healthcare lobby is. And I make reference to that in No Shortcuts in the beginning. In fact, I say something like, people who want to win single payer will misunderstand the power analysis needed. When would they see that we can actually, you know, get Medicaid into the budget? Just like we lose healthcare corporations and the insurance industry and the nursing home lobby in the tax bill, which is why we got our asses handed to us. And to me, it was very obvious we weren't going to stop the tax cuts, like super obvious, because the healthcare corporations would realign with their actual day-to-day natural alliance, which is other corporations and the super rich, right? So I think in single payer, we're nowhere near the power that we need to win it. That's the point. We would need to have way more power to actually take on the single payer fight and win it. I mean, we can't even win it in California, for God's sakes, and it's about as blue as it gets right now.
I'm speaking with the organizer and writer, Jane McAlevey.
Okay, let's shift gears to the Supreme Court. There are a couple of Supreme Court decisions coming up that will affect the labor movement very profoundly. One is quite well known and the other is barely known at all. So, like, let's take each in turn.
Yeah, it's super interesting. So there's a case called the Janus case, which is Janus versus AFSCME. And that's the case that's getting a lot more coverage right now, both in the progressive media as well as even sort of mainstream coverage. The Janus case is coming out of Illinois, out of, you know, the Bruce Rauner empire, where Bruce Rauner actually... Did you see the National Review, by the way?
No.
This month? So the National Review, speaking of weird alliances, you know, a magazine that I've never enjoyed for a second of my life, has a cover story right now with an incredible cartoon caricature of Bruce Rauner, the governor of Illinois. And the National Review, so the right wing, just announced that Bruce Rauner is the worst, most incompetent GOP leader in the country. And I was like, woohoo! Anyway, so that's the cover of the National Review right now. But so the Janus case is coming out of the Rauner attack, the systematic attack on unions. The Janus case now is essentially going to make right to work the law of the land in what's called the public sector in this country. So teachers, unions, firefighters, all government workers. And by the way, what's strategic about that, of course, because the right does think about power and power structures better than the left or progressives. What's strategic about it is there's a whole bunch of states where we have the largest unions in the country. Those unions, like SEIU and AFSCME and the teachers unions, NEA and the AFT, are sort of safe in states like California, New York, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Washington, Oregon, right? The sort of the crisis we have of like strength in the on the coasts, on the Northeast and on the West Coast. And no matter how many times the right wing has tried to go after them, they can't really go after the public sector because public sector trade union law follows national patterns, but it's made state by state. So the attempt to wipe out unions in the private sector, they could run a sort of a national campaign, but it's been very hard for the right to go after unions because in a state like California, where there are millions of trade unionists paying good money for dues money and good money into the political process, right, that gets funneled into our national campaigns, the right hasn't figured out how to attack them. So the Janus case, which builds on, which will have the same effect as what was called the Friedrichs case, right, California Teacher Association versus Friedrichs. Trade unions were facing the same moment in early 2016, and then we had the quite well-timed death of a major Supreme Court justice. So in a case that would have achieved what Janus will achieve, which is essentially making all membership in the so-called public sector unions voluntary going forward, so no one has to pay dues. Majority workers vote to join a union, and in a right-to-work model, no one actually has to pay dues. They're going to essentially take that model and apply it, and they're digging into the states that they couldn't get at a state-by-state strategy by making it a Supreme Court ruling. What they're trying to do is gut what's left of trade unions, because what's left of trade unions is in the public sector. So that's what Janus will do.
Now, and for the right, this has two charms,
yes,
at least. One is that it undermines the bread and butter side of things, the economic issues, wages, working conditions, pensions, all that sort of thing. But it also damages a very crucial support mechanism for the Democratic Party.
Politics.
So this is like a double-barreled victory for
them. No, it's a triple barrel. Actually, the double-barrel part that you're talking about is, look, the fact is, I'm sick of it, for all the like progressive mealy-mouth and liberal, certainly mealy-mouth attacks on unions, oh, they could be better, they could be this, they could be that. Yes, of course they could be, right? I mean, you and I agree on this fundamentally. On the other hand, they're all that's left right now. So what they're doing is going after the biggest money source, right? Because these unions and these key states in the public sector unions are, in fact, the largest source of financial backing for all progressives in the the Democratic Party. It's the biggest source of campaign funds in the country, and that's what they're really going after. But the trifecta for them is that they also understand that actually, structurally, the most powerful defenders of government and the concept of government right now are also the government workers' unions. So the trifecta is they're actually trying to kill the state. Right? So if they win on Janus, in their minds, they're also going to gut the state. Because if they gut the state-based pro-government, pro-tax unions, it's a third fantasy of theirs. It's like they're having three important goals at once, which is attacking unions, attacking the political source of money for the Democrats, and frankly, attacking the public sector.
And given the configuration of the Supreme Court, this is a certain victory for them.
Yes. There's no question.
Okay, and then Murphy Oil, which I hadn't heard until last night, so tell us about that.
Yeah, so Murphy Oil is a case in many ways with even more ramifications. And what's interesting is we can even loop it into the current very rich woman upper class debate we're having about sexual harassment in this country. It's really important in the context of the debate going on. So like maybe feminists will, you know, or the women's groups will care about Murphy Oil as soon as I finish this. But, you know, because they probably don't even understand it. So Murphy Oil was also heard in early October, like the opening day, I think, within 2 days of the opening of the Supreme Court. They heard the Murphy Oil case. Almost no one, when I ask people in the movement, like no one's heard of it. So Murphy Oil, it's a little bit complicated, but let me try and make it as simple as I can. It's essentially an attack on the alt-labor movement. Like in the simplest analysis of it, it's gonna gut a lot of what's given groups like the Restaurant Opportunity Center, the Immigrant Worker Centers, Make the Road New York, Center for Popular Democracy, like a lot of the groups that have been getting some traction.
Organizing outside the immediate workplace.
Organizing workers, but not through a union, mm-hmm. Right? The whole, again, in some ways, a set of people who I'm fairly, you know, I can be either fairly or somewhat critical of depending on the person, because it's not easy to lump together where the critique of the unions come from, but there's a whole cacophony of people out there who are like, labor unions are dead. It's time to move on to new formations. You hear it everywhere, right? Like the trade union movement is dead. So we need to come up with David Rohl famously, the one who I analyze in No Shortcuts, how weak his contracts are and stuff. But he's like, he, Andy Stern, in his post-SAU days now, a ton of like policy wonks. You can, if you Google like the death of the labor movement, you will see like all these people who are allegedly progressives talking about how unions are dead and we can never rebuild them. So we need foundation funded efforts to help poor workers have some basic rights on the job. And that's the unions are dead people. And I've been fighting that idea every day that I wake up that I can, because, and so the Murphy Oil case is going to show it. So the people who have said unions are dead, they overlay with the whole philanthropic sector and a super rich people in the Democratic Party who are aligned with Wall Street, who would very much like unions to be dead, because unions actually, when we do our work right, still have power. And we now have exercised great power and have led to great redistribution of wealth in this country. So I think if you look at the Democratic Party's complicity in killing unions for the last 30 years, right, there's like at no time, including Barack Obama and the Employer Free Choice Act, Carter. I mean, you can look at every time that Bill Clinton, you can look at every moment that there was a Democrat with 60 votes in the Senate. Did the Democratic Party do anything to actually restore or rebalance the power of workers to form unions? The answer is no. So we can argue that the Democrats have been completely complicit in undermining and allowing sort of the slow, if not faster than slow, death of trade unions. So this whole sort of like, they're too afraid of actual power, which is what unions are, like when the working class actually builds power. That whole set of sort of liberal class people in this country have been championing what they call alt-labor for the last 5 to 10 years. So we can have, community-based organizations and worker centers, traditionally very weak, doing things like wage theft cases, right? Like, oh, there's a bunch of workers who had their, who make minimum wage. And it's even really bad because they're undocumented labor. And it turns out that the boss has been ripping them off and making them stay after work for 2 hours, and they're not getting any overtime, and they don't get overtime pay to begin with, and the boss has just abused them. So there's been this really interesting and very good work done around like anti-wage theft cases by a lot of immigrant worker centers. So all of that work, all of the work that's been gurgling up as sort of interesting work in the alt-labor movement, has been relying on what's called the protections of Section 7. This is where it gets weird, but hang with me. Protections of what's called Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act / the Wagner Act, passed in 1935. And so Section 7 protections, to not sound lawyerish about it, but to try and sound like an organizer, are essentially what make it so that something called concerted activity can happen by workers in the workplace. Now, historically, from 1935 until the Murphy Oil case, Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act protects any what's called concerted activity on the part of workers. So anytime workers come together to do something together, the law says you're protected and your boss can't fire you for standing up for your rights. That was written primarily to help trade unions advance, right, in the New Deal in 1935. But in the last 5 to 10 years, a lot of very clever lawyers with a lot of very clever organizers in sort of the alt-labor movement have figured out how to use what's called the Section 7 protections under the National Labor Relations Act so that all sorts of immigrant worker, low-wage worker organizing could happen, and employers couldn't fire workers when, for example, you would team up thousands of workers in a wage theft claim or an overtime claim. Murphy Oil is an overtime claim by a bunch of workers who weren't getting overtime, and we called it wage theft. So a case came forward, and essentially, fast forward, what this is going to do is end, once and for all, the protections for workers who are trying to do organizing work, not with a union. Their protections will be stripped if Murphy Oil goes in favor of the employer class. And in June, so the Obama administration was teaming up with the National Labor Relations Board, the Obama board, and the Obama Department of Labor were on the same side, and they were coming out against the employers for workers. At the technical heart of this lawsuit, Murphy Oil, is whether or not the Federal Arbitration Administration, there's two different acts, and the right-wing class is playing them. So National Labor Relations Act says workers who come together have protection, whether or not they're forming a union or whether or not they want to have a class action lawsuit. And by the way, so fast forward to sexual harassment cases. Let's say that right now a bunch of low-wage women like maids, nannies, women who don't have unions want to get together because sexual harassment's the topic of the day, and they want to get together and have a class action lawsuit against their employer because they don't have a union, right? Because they don't have a union. So they're going to get together and have a class action lawsuit against their boss because it turns out you know, working class women get fielded up and harassed and abused far more than a handful of wealthy women. Not that anyone should suffer this abuse. But so this Murphy Oil case will actually prevent millions of women in this country from dealing with a sexual harassment crisis unless and until, and only unless, they have a union. Anyone who doesn't have a union will be barred from having a class action lawsuit around sexual harassment if Murphy Oil goes through. It's an unbelievably devastating lawsuit. It set its guns on defanging the alt-labor movement. And part of what I said to people in the last few years in debates about, our union's dead, we can have a new alt-labor movement, da-da-da-da-da, is, you know, this is great. It's all lovely. But the minute alt-labor becomes powerful enough to matter to employers, they're going to kill you. And that's exactly what Murphy Oil is doing. So we're back to the idea of, gee, can we be smart enough to actually form unions? Because they're going to make it so Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act is narrowly interpreted and will, in fact, continue to protect the concerted activity of workers trying to form a union. But if workers want to form a sexual harassment lawsuit against their boss, game over. You can be fired for doing that. If the Supreme Court goes the way we think they will on Murphy Oil.
All right, then I want to hand over the microphone to Liza Featherstone, and you can have a conversation about these and other matters that turn up. Thanks, Jane.
I was Jane McAlevey, the writer and organizer. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
You say that you wanna go to a land that's far away. How are we supposed to get there with the way that we're living today? You talk lots about God. Freedom comes from the call, but that's not what this bitch wants. Not what I want at all. I want money, power, and glory. I want money and all your power, all your glory. All I know who we are. I wanna take you for all that you got.
That was some of Money, Power, Glory by Lana Del Rey. And now I'll turn over my microphone to Liza Featherstone, the journalist who's written extensively on gender and work. Her book, Selling Women Short, about the sex discrimination suit against Walmart, was published in 2005. Her edited collection, False Choices, a set of essays in Hillary Clinton's faux feminism, was published by Verso in May 2016. And her book about focus groups, Divining Desire, is just out from Orr Books. Ethics requires me to disclose that Liza is my wife. With sexual harassment very much in the news, I thought it would be very good to have two serious feminists talk about the role of capitalism and economic power in the pervasive culture of harassment. Hillary-style neoliberal feminism just doesn't have the answers, but Liza Featherstone and Jane McAlevey have some good ideas.
Liza Featherstone, it is really always a pleasure to see you.
It's so great to see you, Jane.
Yeah. So, you know, on this question of sort of sexual harassment that's making the headlines, I wonder what you think about today's Wall Street Journal. I just want to draw your attention to today being Wednesday, December 6th, in the business and finance section. It seems like another non-solution has just been proposed by the capitalists and corporations, which is a headline on the cover of the section called Business and Finance in the Wall Street Journal that says, "Holiday office parties sober up."
It's the
Is that the solution to the crisis, Liza? What do you think?
It's the Ebenezer Scrooge solution to sexual harassment, which is to say the capitalist solution, because Scrooge is no different than any other capitalist in wanting to get the most out of his workers. This is exactly what we might fear we would see out of the, in many ways, wonderful outbursts of testimonials and speakouts that women have been doing on workplace sexual harassment. But, you know, the reason that we're seeing the capitalist solution be no one have any fun at their holiday party is that neoliberal feminism has no actual solution to this problem. Let's take a little bit of a closer look at the memo that the Wall Street Journal reports on. It's the Interpublic Group, U.S. and Canadian company, lays out a number of party don'ts. No kissing colleagues under the mistletoe. No over-the-line gyrating on the dance floor. No posting stupid fun pictures on social media. Off-color jokes are a no-no since, quote, someone might be wired.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, stupid fun in the workplace often turns into regrettable fun the next day, the email read. And regrettable fun has given rise to corporate phrases like HR has received a formal complaint, zero tolerance, and, quote, fired for cause.
Yeah, so there's so many things that strike me about that headline today as like a really good reflection of how inadequate the feminist movement in the States is right now in terms of real solutions. Because first of all, it's not about having less fun at the holiday party. Second of all, when I read that memo, when I'm reading between the lines of that memo, it's essentially a way to protect senior managers from getting in trouble at the holiday party, right?
Absolutely. It's and all what, about them.
Yeah.
It's always
like,
all
careful
about them.
Because the cell phones are on.
Yes.
And it's the one time when the senior managers tend to hang out with their workers, like
yes.
once a year.
Yeah.
Like, workers actually don't meet with senior managers except at the holiday party.
Right.
And, of course, the larger issue is really what's happening every single day in millions of workplaces affecting millions of women.
Yeah.
Who actually don't have any way to redress this when people's cameras aren't on them.
Yeah.
And they're being systematically abused, right? By their employers, not taking away fun at the holiday party.
It is really about the women at the most powerless ends of the labor market, migrant farm workers, most sexually harassed group of people, fast food workers. Women just put up with this all day long in those kinds of workplaces. Retail workers.
Yeah.
I mean,
and Ehrenreich does a good job on this when she talked about in the column she wrote. I mean, I feel like Barbara Ehrenreich has written one of the most sensible,
yes.
if not the most sensible piece so far on this whole topic, which again, I think genuinely, like we're really happy with the sort of off the heads, you know, off with their heads moment that
oh,
we're in.
Oh, sure.
But when Ehrenreich says, like, hello, in fact, a waitress in a tipped economy is essentially, like, the whole structure of a tipping economy
yes.
essentially makes it so she's got a smile when someone's grabbing her ass to get the tip.
Yeah.
Right? It's like the structure of capitalism that's at, and power and patriarchy is actually the crisis. And our solutions so far are like an HR. You know, it's like a human resource solution of not having fun at the party is like actually not what this moment needs to become.
Yeah.
And it's quickly becoming.
It is, it is
something really bad. Like even, you know, waking up and reading that Conyers resigned.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that he was involved in some things that were, you know, not cool, by the way.
Yeah.
And even more than that.
Oh,
right?
I'm,
like outrageous
I'm
behavior.
I'm quite sure.
Yeah. Like outrageous
that.
Behavior.
Yeah.
But to me, it's sort of, to me, it feels like, while we should take responsibility for people on the progressive side of the aisle, this is a game of power.
Yes.
Like we're talking about power and corporations and capital. And I don't know, I feel like we're leaving like the sexual harasser in chief in the White House.
Yeah.
And instead people are obsessing about like Franken and Conyers. And to me, a movement demand should be, their response to this should be, look, we're happy to step down the minute the president resigns.
Yeah.
Because he's on recorded video talking about grabbing women's pussies, right?
Yeah.
Like, so
just
the way that we're, all the responses that we're seeing are really inadequate to the task and sort of like off the central point.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and again, what neoliberalism is sort of leads to is this kind of, I mean, it's almost sort of like a ritual suicide by the Democratic Party. Like, well, our constituents care about the harassment of women. So, you know, we're going to just sacrifice, and the Republican base doesn't care whether their politicians harass or even rape women.
Yeah, not at all.
And so what we're ensuring here is essentially a permanent rapist government, which I don't think is what anyone wants. And it's all about what you talk and write about all the time, which is the lack of a theory of power.
Yeah.
And like, how would we actually get from here and there, here to there, instead of just moral witnessing? And it makes everyone feel good to say, well, the Democrats are just as bad as the Republicans, although that is just never true.
Yeah.
They are very bad, but they are actually not just as bad, including on this issue.
Yeah.
Like,
Roy Moore was like banned from a suburban mall.
A mall.
Yeah, anyway.
I know. Then grabbing someone's ass becomes equivalent to locking a 14-year-old in the car. I don't think those things are exactly equivalent.
Yeah.
So that's part of it. But again, I think the thing that really is so striking about this is the reason we're in these crazy political cul-de-sacs, right, where where somehow we have to denounce all these people and we have to denounce all of them equally, and we have to hashtag about that. The reason for that is that neoliberalism and HR-driven feminism cannot solve this problem. What can solve this problem is more power for women,
right,
and more economic power for women.
Yeah, economic power for women, for sure. And in the short term, it'd be amazing if, like, everyone who was involved in the naming and shaming was demanding right away a full expansion of union rights. And why don't we figure out how to actually structurally empower women workers in the workplace, which last I looked requires basically coming together and forming collective action. And that means having a union. And by the way, just to connect this to the earlier conversation in terms of power, you know, while the corporations are writing memos saying don't have fun at the holiday party, they're also advancing this Murphy Oil case,
yes,
which is literally going to gut the capacity of women in the workplace to come together if they don't have a union and have a class action lawsuit against their corporate employer for systematic serial violations of their rights, right? So it's like, you know, somewhere like lost in the conversation. I mean, I have not yet heard any prominent people standing up and saying, right, the first solution is we have to deal with the power imbalance of women workers in the workplace, right? And last I looked, the best and only way that I can figure out how to do that in this country is about having strong unions. And I mean, if you look at some of the European, right, if you go back to like your point, which I think is so excellent about that neoliberalism has no solution to this, so except to name and shame. Right, which is not the point.
And humiliate and fire, which in the case of these bad bosses like Harvey Weinstein, of course, super happy to see that.
We could have a lot of fun dancing about all of the guys who are doing naming and shame.
And
right?
We should. We don't want to take away anyone's fun from that.
Yeah, we actually just want a systematic solution that addresses power imbalance in the American workplace. And in Europe, places like the Scandinavian countries, where women have like 76, where they're covered like at the level of 76% of all workers are in unions.
Yeah.
They have very different solutions, and they don't have the kind of harassment that we have that's exploding onto public view right now.
No, they don't, and particularly in the countries, in the Scandinavian countries, where they have that and also have extremely high female labor force participation. You know, because some European countries vary a little bit on how much women actually participate in the workforce. In all of those countries where they have extremely high union membership and extremely high labor force participation by women, they're not being harassed. And another reason that that I think we see such low workplace harassment in those countries is the broad economic support for women. You know, where you have income supports for women who want to leave their jobs for some reason or another, or where you have universal health care, child care, where you're not stuck in your workplace, you are not treated like garbage.
Right.
And that applies to so many different kinds of workplaces of abuses, of which sexual harassment is one. You know, where you can actually say, take this job and shove it, bosses know it.
That's right.
And they treat you better.
Yeah, absolutely. At some extreme, having just spent a bunch of time in Sweden, they are systematically addressing sort of the inequities of power almost constantly in the Scandinavian countries. So one example is Okay, so if you're in the Scandinavian countries, and I can say specifically in Sweden, but it's true throughout the Scandinavian countries, where union membership is incredibly high, where, as you're saying, women's participation in the labor force is really high. They even recently decided to change the way the maternity and paternity leave works, because they realized as a social goal that women were using their full year of maternity leave, and even though men could use, men could also do it,
they weren't.
And so, you know, at the Swedish state, like, they just changed the law. Basically, you'll get more maternity and paternity leave only if the husband actually stays. It's unbelievable.
I
it's
love
like
that they did
they're
that,
make but... they're like making it so that men actually have to stay home and take care of the kids. Like, yeah. You want to have them,
yeah.
You know, so they already have incredible maternity and paternity leave.
Yeah.
Compared, you know, we've like nothing here, right? So they have an amazing maternity and paternity leave, and they have huge union participation rates, union density rates. We're naming and shaming bad harassers, and they're figuring out how to make it so that men and women both raise the kids equally with socialized state support.
Yeah.
It's just
like
we're on it, like, and we're, and we're having hashtags. I'm sorry. It's just, it's deep.
There was a very charming little news story about a town in Sweden that had proposed letting workers have more time off at lunch for conjugal visits with their spouse.
Wow.
And the way that this was debated was extremely charming. So, so here, that would be like a non-starter because a loss of productivity, and why are you even talking about the sex?
Yeah.
Like, it's the workplace.
Yeah.
And there it was debated and ultimately went down because it was not fair to people who were not in couples, because this is a benefit they would not enjoy, which is a very sweet objection.
Yeah, very sweet.
And also why sex people might have other things they want to do, like gardening.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's like,
you're right to garden.
They're just discussing these issues on completely different terms than we are.
Yeah, which I think just people in our country don't realize.
Yes.
You know, they just don't realize.
No, people don't realize the everyday implications of having completely different economic policy.
We're listening to Jane McAlevey, the writer and organizer, and the journalist Liza Featherstone.
So if you and I were in charge of the solutions right now, what are some of the solutions that we think would be really good alternatives to, again, we're down with the off with their heads moment, but what are some of the things that are missing, and what are the things that we think we should actually be doing about this? I mean, I want to start by saying, sort of reiterating the piece that I was talking about earlier, which is the yawning gap. When it's upper class women calling attention to a sexual harassment crisis, the solution is naming and shaming, and it's not. What we need are to rebuild unions in the workplace so that working class women actually have some structural power to deal with systematic abuse. So, like, that's missing from the conversation to me. Like, the whole discussion of power, patriarchy, like, it just doesn't seem like it's in the discussion right now.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And again, let's emphasize, of course, in addition to you and I, Barbara Ehrenreich has been mentioning that Michelle Chen and Sarah Leonard have also called attention to that piece. I mean,
absolutely.
Other labor left feminists have been talking about this.
Power and working class women.
Yes.
But it's not making the headlines, that's for sure.
It's not. And I think that, I mean, one of the reasons is the solutions that we're talking about, more power for working class women, which we know how that is achieved through union organizing and the kinds of economic policies that we're describing, which are only achieved by building working class power in the ways that you've written about. But I think one reason we're not seeing that is, as you suggest, because the discourse is so led by upper middle class women who essentially just want to complain to the HR department. Like, they want to, and they want to see bad apples fired, and they genuinely think that your fired liberalism, as I call it, is going to get us out of this. And for the vast majority of working women, that's just not going to work. I also think there's kind of a pornography in the whole discussion, right? I mean, that if what like, you know, even though what is really going to change this for most women is belonging to strong unions, that just doesn't get nearly as much attention as he touched you where?
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, that gets everyone's attention.
Yeah.
But then that's where the conversation starts because it's so attention getting. Yeah. I mean, it starts and stops there.
Yeah, and it's right. It's absolutely right. And but partly also, I mean, when we think about, you know, that the solution is that we rebuild a stronger trade union movement that actually has feminist-oriented solutions to it, I think that there's such a basic misunderstanding on the part of the vast majority of people in the pundit class about how a union works,
yes,
that they won't even understand that, like, obviously unions are, they just don't get it. I mean, there is I think we've probably talked about this in the past too, but like the number of people who sit in the pundit world have probably almost never even had or needed or had no experience with a union, and may not have any woman in their family who actually get abused in a daily way, where it'd be more obvious that the solution would be like, do we have something, have we achieved something called a union contract that actually guarantees basic rights for workers on the job?
Yeah. A lot of people in media are kind of getting it, and you actually see more media organizations trying to organize unions.
And we also see what happened. People got a little taste of what happens pretty much all the time, which is
you can get shut down really fast.
I have a question though too. It's like, I feel like some of this is like that people will say things like, you know, if we elect a female president, is this going to go away? Or is the solution just electing more women to office? Because that's another, right? What happens when we elect more women to office? Is that the solution? And I just feel like it still doesn't basically address capitalism and neoliberalism.
Right.
It's not about like electing numbers of women, though. Yeah. I'd love to elect a lot of radical women to office. That'd be great. But, you know, it's still avoiding the systemic structure of power that exists in America's workplaces. And also the power that Wall Street, for sake of argument, and the financial industry, you know, has taken over the Democratic Party. So even if we elect women, like, that going to be one of the solutions, right?
Yeah. What we see is that, I mean, that if you don't change the rest of politics, electing women really makes very little difference. I mean, if you look at, you know, Walmart, the reason, so I wrote a book about the Betty Dukes versus Walmart.
Yeah, really good one, by the way.
Thank you very much, Jane. It was about the largest sex discrimination case in history brought by Betty Dukes, who was a cashier at Walmart, who recently died, sadly. And that case actually got started because a group of lawyers who had who specialized in sexual harassment claims noticed they were getting a lot of claims from Walmart employees, and they said to themselves, you know, where you see so many harassment claims, there is usually something structurally very wrong with the inequality of women in that workplace, and there are usually vast disparities in pay and promotion as well, because women are just fundamentally exploited and not respected in that company. So they did a discovery as part of a sexual harassment claim. They were and they got all of this data that showed that it was exactly as they had conjectured. Women were paid less in every position and promoted more slowly, although their evaluations were overall much better. Their performance evaluations, they were promoted much more slowly. Classic. I mean, if the issue could not have been more materially embedded. While women were describing, you know, their supervisors following them into the cooler and, you know, badgering them for blowjobs, they were also being told, a monkey could do your job.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're paying this guy less, more because he has a family to support, although you are a single mother. This was literally what was happening.
And so, they're a profound union busting company, by the way.
And they are a profound union busting company where workers are summarily fired for organizing unions, and units are routinely simply shut down in the United States when workers have attempted to unionize. The point of that long that long description is both to show that how structural this issue is, but also to answer your question, would having a woman president change this? Hillary Clinton was the first female board member of Walmart. She always said she was very proud to serve on the board of Walmart. She never made any public statements
about the vast sexual harassment going on
about
inside the company.
Vast sexual harassment and systematic discrimination at the company. The disparity between the progress of Hillary Clinton and the progress of the vast majority of Walmart workers on this issue, it couldn't be more
stark.
It couldn't be more stark, and it couldn't be more separate. She could have been elected president. Women would, most working women would be in exactly the same situation that they are.
Yeah, I think that very lawsuit, I think it's interesting because if I'm reading the Murphy Oil case that's going to be ruled on by the court in a way that I imagine is going to be a 5-4 decision, right, by the controlling interests, I'm pretty sure that in a future, the ability to even do that lawsuit would have been challenged. Murphy Oil is going to strip the ability of something like a class action. It's going to strip the protections that the woman would have to even bring a class action lawsuit.
That's right. And that's why, as usual, we really need to be talking about power.
Yeah, power and the patriarchy and capitalism. Great talking to you.
You too, Jane.
That was a conversation between the journalist Liza Featherstone and the writer-organizer Jane McAlevey. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out there, some of Glass City by the Baltimore-based feminist punk band War on Women from their eponymous 2015 album. The band's lead singer, Shauna Potter, was in this show in October. Till next week, bye.